On Transportation and Economic Development. It is Wednesday, March the 12th, 2003. And at this time, I'm going to open as a subcommittee of the subcommittee a public hearing on House Bill 5029 with a tap of the gavel. We'll do that. And at this time, I've asked Rick to talk to us about some things that we saw yesterday as we were going through the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I thought it was important to point out one thing in particular. As we talked about the budget yesterday, it was mentioned that there was a reduction of $6.3 million general fund during the special sessions. What wasn't mentioned was that of that $6.3 million, $6 million of that was backfilled with other funds. $3 million came from unrestricted cash reserves that the department had that the legislature directed the agency to use to backfill $3 million in general fund. The other $3 million came from previously unallocated new revenue that came from interest earnings off the housing trust fund that the agency came forward with. So I just want to be sure that that was on the record and members here knew that even though there were $6.3 million general fund reduction, that was backfilled with $6 million so that the program impact was not as great as it would have been had it been the entire $6.3 million. So I just want to be sure that that was pointed out to the committee.
Bob, would you like to respond to that?
I'll do it a little later.
I'm a cleanup. Oh, okay. All right. And the question I had, and I would like to get this on the record, because as you folks know, these are really, really tough budget times, is are there any other pockets of $3 million out there that we can identify that you folks can put the hold on those dollars? Are you going to do that?
Yeah.
All right. Senator Morris.
Well, that was the question, thank you, Mr. Chair, that I had. But I do have something specific that I want to recommend. Do you want to wait?
Let's do that. Okay, I'll wait for you to do that.
Okay.
All right. Who's first this morning? Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rick Crager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. We are in the final stages of our budget presentation here. We have three presentations left from our people that I like to call behind the scenes. So I'm sure this is the most highly anticipated moment of the presentation when you've got a bean counter, a computer nerd, and compliance junkie here to close out. So we'll do our best to run us through the next half an hour, and then Director Repine will come back and close us off and respond to a lot of the questions that you have. At this point, am going to introduce Marla Slaver to my left, who is the Asset and Property Management Division Administrator, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about the APM Division.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As indicated, my name is Marla Slaver. I'm the Division Administrator for the Asset Property Management Division. My division monitors department finance multifamily rental communities after the loans and grants are closed and the communities are in operation. The division also completes contract administration duties for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, who you've heard referred to previously as HUD. The communities are located throughout the state. They vary in size from 40 units to over 200 unit apartment communities. And my division specialized staff monitors the communities through a variety of functions. The result of our monitoring practice is an assurance that community and department standards are maintained and that low and moderate income Oregonians live in decent, safe, well-maintained sanitary housing. In addition, our monitoring duties ensures that our bondholders are held harmless and that their investments are protected. Our division is comprised of two sections, the Housing Programs Management Section, with a current staffing level of 14 FTE, and we are requesting three additional staff positions in the Governor's 2003-2005 balanced budget for a total of 17 FTE, and the HUD Contract Administration Section with a current staffing level of 11 FTE. We are also asking for approval today of the continuation of one limited duration position funded through August of 2003 for our division. And we passed out to you today a series of graphs, and I will be referring to them as we go through my presentation. In 1999, Congress mandated that HUD enter into contracts with state agencies and others to complete monitoring duties to ensure that HUD's portfolio of apartment communities are maintained in such a manner that is acceptable to HUD. This is often referred to as the devolution of HUD. On September 1, 2000, Oregon Housing and Community Services entered into an annual contributions contract with HUD to provide contract administration duties for HUD-insured communities located throughout the state. It was at that time that Oregon Housing and Community Services formed the HUD Contract Administration Section. The initial contract is for a duration of 5 years, and Oregon Housing and Community Services receives fees to cover the cost of performing 16 incentive-based performance standards at acceptable quality levels. The chart titled HUD Contract Administration Number of Contracts per Compliance Officer shows how the number of contracts or communities monitored by the HUD Contract Administration Section has increased from 82 in September of 2000 to 175 as of February 2003. I think it's also important to note that more than likely we will be close to the 175 number. There's not very many properties left that HUD will be sending to us. We got them in a rather staggered way because this was a new, throughout the nation, a new trial period that HUD was using to get state agencies and others to do monitoring. And so we started with a slow number and moved upward. And as HUD kept working through those trouble projects, we continued to get them. But I think we're very close to having the maximum number that we have now. Completing contracts for the HUD has enriched not only the lives of those low-income Oregonians that live in Section 8 communities, but also the neighborhoods surrounding these communities. In 2003-2005 Governor's Balanced Budget, we are requesting that you extend 11 FTE limited duration positions and permit us to make HUD subsidy payments in the amount of $36,157,000. To the owners of these communities. And I may want to add that the number of subsidies, the dollars actually flow from HUD. My division acts as a conduit and passes that money on to the owners of the communities. The second section I have is a housing programs management section, and it ensures through Oregon Housing and Community Services communities comply with bond indenture provisions and that they are operated in compliance with applicable state, federal statutes, regulations, and rules. These regulations govern areas such as the physical integrity of the community, accuracy of tenant files, and the owner's agent's responsibility relating to the day-to-day operation of the communities. The past biennium has both been exciting and challenging for us. Housing programs management has been able to build a strong and committed relationship with owners, management agents, residents, and site staff. The partnership with both sponsors and agents is very important to achieve success with each of our communities. And although our resources have been very limited, we've been able to conduct some individual training to assist our partners in their success, as well as offer challenges that they may face. Quarterly performance measurements are completed on the department's finance Section 8 projects, and we have had a combined 11.5 increase in the number of projects receiving superior or satisfactory ratings over the past 2 years. These scores are based on several indicators reviewed during the annual management review and physical inspections. The past biennium has seen an expansion of the multifamily housing program and an increase in the tax credit authority from $1.25 per Oregonian to $1.75, dramatically increasing our monitoring responsibilities. And I believe in the last few days you've heard this referred to as a 40% increase. It's effectively a 40% increase in those projects that must be monitored. As you can see from the second chart, the Housing Programs Management Section summary of monitored projects, the number of communities to be monitored during the 2003-2005 biennium is projected to increase approximately 32% since the beginning of the 2001-03 biennium. The chart takes into account all of our major funding sources that include low-income housing tax credit projects, home, risk share, elderly disabled, and our conduit multifamily communities. The increase in the number of communities monitored, as well as changes mandated by the Internal Revenue Service Code and Housing and Urban Development, have required more frequent and in-depth monitoring. Following are some of the specific program or legislation changes that have impacted monitoring Oregon Housing Community Services projects. The IRS has mandated that file audits and physical inspections of low-income housing tax credit communities should be conducted every 3 years versus every 5 years, adding approximately 140 communities a year that must be inspected. They also require increased information on when filing non-compliance reports and now require that we monitor for lead-based paint issues in projects that are old enough to have lead-based paint and that are being rehabilitated. The Real Estate Assessment Center is a U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development national management center created to centralize the way that HUD evaluates the physical inspections and conditions, as well as the financial condition of HUD properties. This applies to both the department's risk share program and also Section 8 projects. Oregon Housing Community Services compliance monitors are charged with the responsibility of reporting to HUD once owners and agents have completed the needed physical repairs as indicated by the REACT inspections. As you can see, all of the monitoring responsibilities have become much more complex, yet our staff has not increased significantly in the past 3 years. The last chart on the back page, titled the Housing Programs Management Section, Number of Properties per Compliance Officer, will detail the increase of communities each compliance officer is responsible for and the dramatic increase since 1994 with only the addition of two compliance officers. The number of communities that the six compliance officers were responsible for in 1999 was approximately 97 communities. This increased from 28 communities in 1994 quickly due to the addition of several new programs that include home, risk share, conduit, and the low-income housing tax credit program. It actually was in our housing division. It was monitored at the housing division, and asset property management took over those duties during that time. Today, with eight compliance officers, the number of communities in each compliance officer's portfolio is approximately 100. Continuing this trend, the number of communities monitored by each compliance officer would be 114 in the 2003-05 biennium. With the addition of the three FTE, the average portfolio size would decrease to approximately 83 communities per compliance officer, well above the national norm of 45 communities, but certainly more manageable. The continued use of our personal digital assistant devices, and it's a device that we use, it's called a PDA. It's a device that we're now able to use on our inspections. We used to go out and do inspections literally with a pad of paper and a pencil. And with these, and with the help of our IS department, we've been able to develop a program in which we literally can go out and do inspections and point and click, come back, dock those into our stations, and it actually just prints out the report for us. In the past, we've had to do that by hand, then come back in Word or Word Perfect and type out the reports. So that's one of the reasons we've been able to keep ahead of this as much as possible. Communities are assigned geographically to compliance officers to be as cost-effective as possible. Each compliance officer must be very knowledgeable in the regulations governing all funding sources. The six remaining FTE in the Housing Programs Management section are responsible for a variety of functions that include audits to ensure financial integrity, processing housing assistance payments, invoicing and collecting low-income housing tax credit monitoring fees, processing the elderly certifications, and completing vacancy reports for all bond finance properties. It is our goal to enhance the quality of our communities. They mean very much to us, for all Oregonians, through the monitoring compliance to ensure safe, well-maintained, affordable housing. It is our fear that without the additional staffing, we will not be able to ensure that the department's investments are maintained in a manner that preserves the integrity of the site financially, physically, and regulatorily. Thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Dukes?
Do you monitor for, indoor air quality, particularly molds and that sort of thing?
Mold is a very big hot issue right now. You can see it's been in the paper a lot. We really don't have the ability to monitor air quality in any precise way. However, mold is definitely written up as a compliance issue and a physical standard that needs to be repaired.
And how do you follow up on the repairs?
Now,
how do you know that it isn't just painted over?
Oh, you can tell.
No, I mean, I know you can tell. How do you as an agency follow up?
We ask, when we go out and do the inspection, we will make a listing of all the findings throughout every one of the units. And oftentimes you will see mold on a ceiling, which typically means that possibly the roof is leaking, or you will see mold on the inside of the units, inside the windows. We write it up on inspection report. It is sent to the management agent and owner, and then they are required within a certain period of time, generally 30 days, to tell us that it has, in fact, been completed. Unfortunately, due to the time constraints we have and the amount of properties we have, we often don't have time to go back and double-check it until the next year. And then, of course, we take the inspection from the year previous and go and make sure if we do look at the same units that, in fact, has been taken care of.
That's the theory. The practice isn't working that way. I had a constituent, she and two of her children were living in subsidized housing through one of the groups that was represented here yesterday, and suffered huge. I mean, her parents bailed her out financially in terms of all of the medical expenses and things that incurred as a result of mold, which occurred from an upstairs apartment leaking down.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no knowledge about what the damage could be. The carpeting in the bedroom that she slept in was saturated.
Oh.
She ended up being told that all of her furniture had to be stored separately, and they had to do separate inspections on each piece of furniture. I mean, not wooden furniture,
it's
but
a huge
sofa
issue
and
now.
That sort of thing.
It's
I think she lost
issue.
The sofa. She complained and complained. She filed written complaints. My office contacted your agency, and we got absolutely no satisfaction. The authority that was responsible for this particular unit ended up doing a little bit, having somebody come in and do a little bit of cleanup work on it and some paint and stuff, but never resolved it. Her parents ended up paying for indoor air quality testing. They brought a firm out from Portland. So, I mean, it's all there. And we know that it was not, for people who are susceptible to that, it was not a safe place for them to be. But we ended up getting no satisfaction. So I was curious as to what the process should be. And not only no satisfaction, but the authority in that had the responsibility for this unit was not even vaguely interested. It was not very nice about it.
Now, when you say the authority that was responsible for it, would it be a housing authority?
Yes.
It's unfortunate that that happened.
Yeah,
I can tell you that when we, and obviously we don't monitor, other than, you know, looking at the units that we may have that Housing Authority has received money from us for or received some kind of a grant, we monitor for that and the management practices. I would be happy to check into that.
Your agency was notified.
I was not aware of
sure
it. I'm sorry. It didn't trickle down to me.
Yeah. I'm sure that's the case.
From time to time.
And air quality is a tough one. You can probably get 70% of the people, and it won't bother them any. I mean, I don't know what the real statistics are, but there are a certain number of people who I end up with, I mean, she ended up losing her business over this. Because she couldn't, the physical effects were so severe, and it took so long to get it worked out of her system.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dixon, I'm very sorry to hear that. I know that oftentimes we will get calls about mold, and of course, really, it is a management issue and an owner issue. But with any of the properties that we've gotten, that we've had requirements or inquiries from resident managers, residents, we follow it up right away. So I'm sorry. I'm just unfortunate that we were not aware of that.
Yeah, I just was curious as to what the process was meant to be. And it sounds like a good process.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. I think I either asked the chairman or someone yesterday, what is your connector to local agencies. Somewhere along the line, Mr. Chairman, issues of this nature must not just come to the attention of the state, but there is some kind of way that we can call for this agency to do an investigation. Mm-hmm. Whatever that procedure is, I want to make sure that it's done. And so I will speak to the chairman, because the director of the agency, because some kind of way pressure should be brought to bear on what local housing agencies are supposed to be doing as it relates to their partnership mm-hmm. with the state. And I'm hoping that we can create that kind of environment, because this mold situation is becoming an even greater issue. And I know it's not hard for governments to do, but some kind of way pressure needs to be brought to bear. I'm feeling very sad hearing about this story mm-hmm. sitting right here. And that's why I had asked you guys the other day, how do you connect with your partners in making sure that some of these issues are dealt with through some kind of partnership arrangement? Pressure needs to be brought to bear, because no one individual should have to deal with the loss. When you're already down and out, and someone, you lose the little that you do have, you know, because one person's mansion might never be the other person's mansion, you know, because if you have a bed in your house and it's your mansion, that's your mansion. And for the people to have these kind of expenses is just unconscionable. Unconscionable. And I know it's a big issue that you had on, Mr. Chairman, the Sunday news programs, 7 o'clock on Sundays, ABC News.
You're 60 minutes, you mean?
60 minutes. the guy that goes out and gives you money, whatever that show is, Ed McMahon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
He had to move out of his Beverly Hill mansion because the insurance company would not pay for the molding situation that happened in his house, and his wife was very ill from it and everything else. But at least the little that we can do for the voiceless is so important along these lines. And I don't know how we do it,
mm-hmm.
but I would like for Mr. Repine and his agency to bring back to us, Mr. Chairman, I'd like mm-hmm. a letter from this committee
yeah.
to see how do we give Mr. Repine and this agency the kind of note and directive
mm-hmm.
here in working with their partners to bring something to bear. So I'd like for the committee administrator to help us to have a note. A budget note to this effect, so that the partnership arrangement is one where when the agency needs to take some kind of directive from somebody in this body that says, this is what's happening at the local level. It doesn't seem to be working. What can we do at the state level? Mm-hmm. And I'd like the approval of this committee to have that happen. I'm very serious about this.
Well, Rick is right. And I'm really curious, too, as to what kind of authority level do you have relative to that issue? I mean, can you go in and say, this is a condition that must be remediated now? I see somebody handing notes. So
yeah, he's sending me a note. I'll let Rick read that because I can't read and talk at the same time, although I'm pretty good at multitasking. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I certainly understand your concern, and you're right. It is a national issue. We're hoping that some way it will be dealt with on the federal level. We take mold very, very seriously, and it depends for the question that you gave, it depends on what kind of funding source of what punitive damages we may be able to give. For instance, on a Section 8 property, we have 122 on Oregon Housing and Community Services that we have bond financing on. We have the ability, if we have a community manager or owner, actually the owner is ultimately responsible, but generally they'll have a management agent that works for them, that helps them with these kind of issues. And we literally can take away their federal subsidy. We can send them a letter. We can say, you have not addressed this. If it is the mold that I'm talking about that we see is in generally a small area. It may be on the windows, something like that, in the window tracks, because these units are pretty, which is good, tight-fitting.
Right.
But that also, especially if someone has a lot of plants, it's going to create mold, or if they don't turn the fan on in the bathroom, it will create mold. And if it's severe enough, now we have to be very careful. You know, we have to make sure that we have advised HUD that we are going to charge this, that this is what's going to happen. But we literally could take their subsidy away until such time that they did repair it.
Certainly, I want to make sure that we do things before the potential litigation or litigiousness of an act is created. I'm not talking about that. I don't want to teach people how to go in and litigate. I want it to be a cursory conversation between the state and the local partners, and hopefully don't get to the point that you have to pull anything, but bring some kind of pressure to bear that they know you're serious about your relationship with them. And I'm hoping that another one of my colleagues don't have to go through what Senator Dukes went through, because I'm telling you, when you're working alone, and you haven't gotten it yet, Senator, but you'll get it, and that when you're working alone, it's just seems like who else is out there in other districts that are having the same problem that I'm having. Mm-hmm. And I just don't want us to have to give up, but I want us to be able to serve our constituency base in a manner that is conducive to a situation of this nature being resolved. And that's all I'm saying.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think it's also important, and the reason I asked Senator Dukes is what kind of property this was, is because I was wondering if we had any statutory authority over the project. And more than likely, 90% of Housing Authority properties are not under our jurisdiction. Now, apparently, in Senator Duke's case, Oregon Housing was advised at some level. It did not get to my Asset Property Management Division. However, it's unfortunate because we don't have jurisdiction over a lot of the, for instance, the housing authorities. They are our partners, and we work with them. But quite frankly, we don't have the ability to put any punitive damages on them at this time.
I'd like to get to the bottom of this.
My concern is that, now, please know that you gave us some great information, that when I saw all the housing authorities that are partners with you, when it's owned, I know that when it's owned, that means that you can't do anything, okay? But they value your partnership. Let's take my agency. Let's take the Housing Authority of Portland. They own all of their properties.
Yes, they do.
But when they have projects that is coming through the state where you have to partner with them for bonding,
they should know that the partnership is at risk. And by George, something is going to happen when they know that the partnership is at risk. And they don't want to lose that, because I will tell you, if a local agency acts in that manner, when your budget come up the next time, you're going to have a problem with MIPS. Now, where is the pressure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I certainly understand.
Okay. Thank you.
And you're right, it is a very serious issue.
That's right.
Senator Duke.
I'd like to echo that last That's good.
That's right.
But also to say, I hope that there's more follow-up. To say that we've scrubbed the mold off and we've painted it white again is not to say we've fixed the problem. Now, maybe you can teach the tenant to turn on the fan if that was the problem, and that will remedy the problem. In this case, it was water that was coming down, and, you know, that needs to be rectified.
Absolutely.
Or you just have the same problem over again. And the other thing, and I think a lot of people aren't aware, I certainly wasn't until I got dragged through this one, because she advised me regularly as to what was going on, that once it gets into the air, there's a certain period of time before it's out of the air if you do certain things. And so just, again, just cleaning it off and painting over it, which somebody might think, well, it's gone, out of sight, out of mind, isn't always enough to remedy the problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if I may, I can tell you that in this instance, if this had been a property that we had been monitoring, and it doesn't sound like it is, we would have made sure the next year that was, and you're right, it does need to be fixed to take care of the problem. And for instance, we will withhold, we have a replacement reserve. If they were our Section 8 communities, or even the Section 8 communities of HUDs that we do compliance monitoring for, if we see, for instance, that a roof is leaking and it's causing mold, if it's leaking at all, we're going to require, and they can ask us for money from the replacement reserves, and we will require, and often do, that they replace that roof. In this case, had it been a property that we had jurisdiction over, we would have asked them to fix the leak, make sure the tub's not leaking again, eradicate the mold. But you're right. Unfortunately, depending on how serious it is, I would say 90% of the mold that we see in our units, because they are so well maintained, is just a small amount of mold. I think what you're both talking about today is serious, serious mold throughout the unit, and it is very serious.
And the reason that I endorse so heartily Senator Carter's last statements was the attitude of the housing authority in this particular instance was really poor.
It's very
I talked to them personally, and it was just they reached a point where they were no longer willing to help this individual, because she wasn't going to back down. She was going to continue to complain and follow the process through. And there are no repercussions for that.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Carpenter, our Chief Information Officer now, and he's going to quickly go through the Information Services Division. And then after he's done, Mr. Repine will then come up, and I'll join him on the last piece.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Carpenter. I'm the Information Services Division Administrator. And in the interest of time here, I'll be very brief and be happy to answer any questions you have.
Stand by 1 second. Senator Carter.
Just before it starts, Mr. Chairman, so we won't interrupt again, mm-hmm. We have one of the most fabulous universities, photographers, for those of us who graduated from Oregon State, visiting with us today. So you will be seeing him take photographs of all of us, but he's, I think, Senator Smith.
So we sit up straight.
Look at that. Yay! Billy Hennig, go brother.
That's wonderful.
At work here, people. We are going to run out of time. Don't pay attention to us.
right, thank you. In our budget summary, the green binder document on pages 22 and 23, there's an information technology summary, which I would refer you to. I'm afraid it's not a particularly interesting summary, as we're not currently engaged in any large projects, major system upgrades, or IT contracting. But it does have a brief description of our information technology activities. My division provides all the usual computer-related activities and services to the department, such as network and PC configuration and support, systems administration, software support, application development, reporting, and maintaining the department's websites. My division also does some non-computer things. We have a research and planning department that's responsible for producing much of the information that you've had presented to you this week, and we have lots of forecasting we do for housing needs and survey work we do. We also have a communications section that's responsible for external communications. In reference to a question from Senator Dukes on Monday, it's how we notify people that these services are available. We have electronic newsletters. We do radio spots. We have some publications we send out, press releases. We're always looking for ways to get the word out about our activities to the people that would be interested in them. We also work very closely, obviously, with the program area staff to support their programs. The HUD Section 8 that Marlis was talking about is one of our main activities. The loan portfolio management, multifamily housing projects, emergency housing programs. We support the energy programs, low-income energy assistance and weatherization programs. Through a project that I believe Mr. Kenny talked about on Monday called Opus. That is an activity I'm particularly interested in because it gives us a chance to work with our partners, the community action programs, city and county governments, and other interested outside parties. We work with them on housing locator with the city of Portland. There's a statewide 211 telephone service project, statewide social services directory project that we're working with. We've recently started working on a homeless management information system. HUD is requiring that the state of Oregon have something in place by September of 2004 for that. We've been meeting with our partners and recently agreed that rather than a regional or piecemeal approach to that, that we'll find a solution that works statewide. And I took it as a real vote of confidence in the kind of the Opus approach to things that they've asked the state to take the lead on that project. Ultimately, like our name, Information Services, we are about information. We're responsible for collecting and storing and reporting it, analyzing it, and making it available. We maintain several Oracle databases and work hard to integrate the information from our own applications, from commercial third-party applications, our partners' information, and all the other resources out there like surveys and census data and whatnot, so that we can provide the information that you and our division administrators need to manage the programs. And with that, I would stop, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Morris. Mr.
Chair, thank you. Explain your relationship with DAS and the services provided by DAS and what you do internally. I noticed that there was an increase in central services charges to you. How does that relate to your IT functions in your department?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, we are a DAS agency, of course, so we work with DAS RMD. They charge, the central services are for data processing, mainframe support, our telephone system. There's a charge for that. There's a number of specific charges that they use to finance their programs that we pay. And I think the increase that you've seen is, trying to remember, is largely on the telephone side. There's been a big increase on the per station charges there. And Yeah, that's the area I know that there's the biggest increase. We work with DAS RMD to try to make sure we don't duplicate services. So generally, we're responsible for the agency's databases and applications, and the larger issues we let them take care of.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, again, Rick Prager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. I am going to, in light of the time, I'm going to provide my written testimony to Mr. Olson to provide to the rest of the staff so they can hear a little bit, know a little bit more about me and the Financial Management Division. So at this time, Mr. Repine is going to come up. I do want to make a quick comment, though, and it might lead into some of Mr. Repine's discussion. Part of the 2003-2005 governor's balanced budget includes a $914,000 reduction to the department's administrative staff. And that's primarily in the service supply and capital outlay categories. I guess I want, the reason I bring this up is that that has the impact from that is as a result of the $3 million that you heard Mr. Olson talk about earlier from our housing finance fund. That particular account pays over a large majority of the department's operations. The reduction of that took away from our earning power and our cash flows by approximately $350,000 per year. So that's a $700,000 biennial reduction. So I guess I want to make sure what I want to leave you with is that $3 million reduction, while it was a quick $3 million from the Housing Finance Fund that provided backfill for the general fund and continued programs, it does have an impact to the staffing of Oregon Housing and Community Services, and you are seeing that as a result in 03-05. We took measures back when this started, or when it was done during the special session, to begin reducing, and under Director Repine's leadership, we've done, in my opinion, a phenomenal job in terms of cutting back those resources, because we had to begin then. The cash flows were impacted immediately. So I just wanted to point that out. I know that Satish brought that up during his presentation and wanted to make sure that was on the record. So with that, Mr. Repine.
It's a total on my good side. We take a 5-minute break so I can just do some stills here.
He wore his mirror.
I wore my banker's suit, yeah.
Well, I was curious. Can we get a report from Grounds Pass? How did that go?
Senator, I can tell you, again, obviously they're still doing the triage of the assessment of the 62 residents, trying to make sure that they meet the housing needs. They're in temporary housing right now, either with relatives or family members who have extended their households for them at this point in time. The key piece is many of them have high different levels of service needs, and so it's important to match the housing that they can be moved into for this temporary permanent time that will meet their, like say they have a, they have to use a walker or a wheelchair. Clearly you can't be putting them in a resident that's got staircases, so we've got to make sure we're matching the right resident placement to the residents themselves, and so that's what's going on right now. The medical issue is particularly has been a large issue. Two companies, Walmart and Rite Aid, have stepped up and agreed to fill the prescriptions for the people. So another piece of the information that was gathered on Monday was to get information from the residents about their doctors, so the staff could contact the doctors, apprise them of the circumstances, and get whatever prescriptions refilled and get them over to Rite Aid and Walmart so they get them done immediately for these people. So, I mean, there's been a huge amount of effort. Clothes banks are being set up by the Red Cross. People are donating clothes. From what I understand, on a phone call yesterday, there's a huge public drive on the media radio to get furniture. People are just really pouring out from their own personal belongings to let these people who lost everything. Some of them lost everything. Some of the developments, their furniture was kept or stayed okay. But for those who lost everything, they virtually, if you know, they're calling for, can you have a sofa? Do you have lamps? Do you have tables? Do you have chairs? And so I think there's really an outcry for the public right now to make sure that these people are given some opportunities.
Okay.
Can I ask just one more thing?
Yes.
What's the timeline in terms of getting them back together in something?
That's really an unfortunate part about this. You know, if you think about the 62 people who live there as a family unit, who are going to grow together and live together until they're no longer around, by just the normal life process. Probably, you know, by the time you reassess these buildings, scrape them down, start all over again, you're probably talking about a year and a half before they're up and running again. Obviously, some of these, there's one lady there that's 92 years old. The hope is that she'll be able to relocate it temporarily to be able to come back if she really wants to. The reality is whether or not that, you know, will happen in that year and a half. So many things can change in individuals' lives. So the hope is that in a very short period of time, a year and a half, which is not short by that measure, but that they'll be able to have that residence back up and running again. So that's the goal of the developer.
Have something to look forward
yeah.
to.
Good. And they do have, and they've been told as of the meeting Monday, that they all have first rights to come back. Just to divert from the discussion. When I went down there, my fear was, as you can imagine, how society has gotten to some degree. It's the finger pointing of who was responsible for what, and the fear was is that there was going to be a sense of hostility amongst the residents, justifiably because of the what has happened to them, and the person who happens to own the building, who was just a victim of the circumstances too. And you know, to every person that I walked past, the developer I was standing next to for most of the meeting, came up to them, hugged them, and said, you know, you did everything you could do, and we love you for it, and we won't abandon you if you don't abandon us. So, you know, I think from his own personal standpoint, he feels like he has accomplished what he needed to accomplish, despite the loss of the property and things like that. He's maintained the value, the integrity of the personal values there for the people.
Thank you, Carter.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, how many families are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, there was 62 residents in the building. So we can assume that there's at least 62 families affected, and I would say it's probably greater than that because many of these people do not have direct relatives living in the community, and so other outside families or extended families have opened their households to them to move in. So it probably has, you know, upwards to 100 families one way or the other that are directly or indirectly involved with these. No, these are all elderly units.
So, if somebody were to get furniture or something like that, is there some place to house it? Is there some agency that's helping them with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'm sure that the city has made, or the community has made arrangements for storage for those facilities. So, again, you got to realize these people are only in temporary housing today. They will be outplaced or replaced into some other housing, which will require furniture. And so even if the furniture was in a short duration in storage, it would probably be used relatively quickly for those who do not have any furniture at this point in time. So I think they have all the logistics they're working on. Again, I have my staff, Debbie Price, down there. I've assigned her the lead of this to organize and coordinate with all the activities. You had asked a question about the emergency response, and I did some investigating around that. I don't want to say that in a negative way, so I don't take it that. I think the community rallied around this fire in a very cohesive way. They have a emergency response program within the Southern Oregon area that actually had fire stations, which I was extremely impressed with, that came as far as Ashland, which is 60 miles away, and Roseburg, which is 60 miles away, to form a backup triage line around the city of Grants Pass in light of as these battalions were falling out to this fire, in case there was any other fire needs to be addressed anywhere in the community, they had to do the backup. And so from what I understand, 8 community fire services were on that fire, either working on the perimeter or were there as reserves to make sure if there was another fire in the community that they could respond to it, because you can't always have all your hoses on one fire and have something else pop up somewhere else. So there was a huge Southern Oregon contingency of a emergency response vis-a-vis the fire and public safety community, a huge one. Red Cross was in there first right at the beginning. Initially with some of the local people, they had not had any experience with this level of catastrophe. When some more seasoned people came in who took better control of it, then they were able to organize and put together very well synthesized deliverable services for these individuals, so that went well. So I think all in all, despite the state's emergency response process, I think the community had a plan and it worked very well at this point in time.
Well, I was thinking about something else.
Go ahead. I want this committee to notice what Mr. Refine is not saying,
that there was no cohesive organization around an emergency response as we know it from the state and from the region. But that being said, even though not only was his property at risk, because it started in an adjoining property, but if you saw that fire, you knew that the community was at risk, especially with the carbon monoxide and all this other kind of stuff that comes from a fire this great. Some kind of emergency response should have come, and those people should not have been at risk by themselves, because there's no way a small community could have exposed to them what is necessary to make sure that their people are safe and secure. So some kind of way, Mr. Chairman, that matchup, we passed this in our committee last time. Senator Courtney's legislation. Somewhere along the line, there should be some kind of coordinated effort so that when something of this nature happens, the local community should not have to use its meager resources to be able to bring the needed regional resources that we need to bear. And so we need to know how that works. And it appears to me that either the Substantive Committee on Economic Development and Transportation should have a hearing as such, certainly the Ways and Means Committee should.
Rick Refine, if you would do something for us, too.
Yes.
If you find that there's not an adequate amount of furniture that's going to be available down there, let us know, because, I mean, you know, we have the ability to move it, to truck it down there. I say we. Mm-hmm. I'll drive a truck, and Margaret will gather
that's
the goodies.
Right. Okay.
So the point being is that, you know, let us know if there's anything like that that we can do.
I will
do
that.
Those folks. Because
appreciate
that is a small community with a major problem.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may, I was asked by the agency to check with the Office of Emergency Management if the state has responded to this incident. When I called the office, they said that it depends on the local area, the local 911 and the local law enforcement agencies to call the Office of Emergency Management and ask to help. And this incident happened on Thursday at around 6 o'clock, and they didn't have any records of that. So
Of them contacting.
So we don't reach out, we respond to requests.
Exactly.
So then, Mr. Richard, maybe having some knowledge of this for your properties, when for your local people, when something this vast happens again, maybe a policy statement going out to them, and not a policy, but, you know, some kind of friendly amendment that this is the means by which you should act and call upon the state to do this, because that is catastrophic to a small community like that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I think your point is well taken, and one of the reasons I've assigned my staff person, because I figured somebody needs to step up and take the lead, that we are going to create, or she will be creating, a template of what are all the attributes or aspects around this type of devastation, what are the natural partners, what are the people who need to be there, who was there that shouldn't be there, and actually create a document, we hope, a template document that says, in the event of these type of catastrophes, fire and or other damaging to structures, this is how a community, and so we can share that actually with all of our partners. We want to have a plan that we can use the same. We only want to go through the practice of it once. We'd rather be very sophisticated on if we ever had to do this again. So we'd like to learn from the first time and have a plan in place for all of our partners. So if this happened in your district or anybody else's district,
exactly,
we could come in and say, here is a plan of what we do with this situation.
Exactly, because the same thing happened in Coos Bay when
right.
They had that big fire. That was just amazing.
Well, you remember Senator Carter also up in the Pearl District last year, they had that huge apartment building that went up in flames also. And of course, there was no occupancy, and they were able to beat the fire back so it didn't spread to other buildings. But it could have had some other consequences easily.
Committee members, you see me getting anxious.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching the clock.
You've taken over your committee.
Sorry. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go ahead and try to sum up a variety of questions that were raised yesterday and then make some final comments. One is... We've circulated to Mr. Olson a question that was asked, I think, by the chair relative to the WIC program versus the other WIC program that's out there. And this is a kind of a narrative answer to it. The upshot of it is a program that's designed for a like population, but also deals with people who are at least 60 years of age. So there is a kind of a different twist to it. There are similarities, but it also serves the elderly, and it says elderly. eligibility for the people cannot participate in both programs at the same time, so there is no dual use of it. But they are two distinct different programs, and in the final paragraph it does tell you where it's being managed through the Salvation Army of in Portland right now, and the caseloads that they have been seeing over the time that this program has been in place. So you're right, there are two programs very similar, but federally distinctively different, I guess. So that's why they have to get reported out as two different kind of programs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
I just report the news.
I know. isn't WIC federal money?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They're both federal programs.
And they do overlap.
They have some commonalities.
Yeah. Okay.
Overlap is probably a good.
Well, yeah, they cover. I mean, the one covers the elderly, which is a great thing, but it also covers the children.
Yeah, the women who are pregnant.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Okay. There was another question asked, and I can't remember who. I think it was on one of the House members asked a question about the food commodities and food subsidies with the food banks. Mr. Kruger, was that you? okay. This is kind of a brief of it. The money was diverted or moved to drought relief and livestock bailout. Representative Hansen was, excuse me. $947 million were diverted to assist the drought-stricken ranchers in the United States. So a great percentage of that money that was used for the commodities that we used to see coming to the state had been diverted for the time being. In an appropriation bill passed last week, $350 million has been restored. That couples with the purchase of commodities, which will bring commodities back to nearly the levels they were in the recent years. So now that with this other crisis over, then the commodities resources will start flowing back to the states.
Sorry.
That's all right.
You answer questions and I ask more. Does that mean when they moved the money over that they suspended buying some of the food, the commodities that they were buying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I would have to do a little more research, and I have some documents here that might have that information.
Don't go do the extra research.
Well, we can. We'll have somebody in my staff read this, and we'll have the answer before the meeting's over with. Not a problem. Item number three is a question was asked yesterday about the Community Incentive Fund. And the activities, I think both Senator Duke and Senator Morse had asked about this.
Senator Morse.
Okay. Senator Morse. This is a recap of the financial pictures of the incentive fund since it was begun in 2001. I think Mr. Krager or Mr. Kenny told you about it was put as an appropriation earlier on, and it was subject to some other things on the lottery-backed bond bill, either coming about or not coming about. In a timely fashion. That's how we got the first original $5 million. So that's what was issued in 2001. You'll see that, as the report suggests, the revenues of the programs of the 2001, 2002, and 2002 Series C sales of bonds and interest from the loan and revolving loans and interest from those proceeds of $457,000, totaling earned a little over $20 million. Then we have anticipated interest from a scheduled bond sale or monies that will be available in May that have not been sold yet for an additional $5 million, bringing the total to $25 million and some change. The obligations, as the front page still reports, and all the documents behind there will support this for you, is in round one is the Exhibit A, which is the funding approval rounds for those projects that a total of value of $4.9 million. The round two of the incentive fund, which is Exhibit B, was a total of $8.6 million. And round one of the Exhibit C, which is the small incentive fund, as Mr. Kenny, I think, was talking to you about, how we broke off a smaller amount of money so smaller communities could compete at a smaller level of projects less than $50,000. There seems to be, again, when you throw all this into a competitive process, it's the theory of the pond with big fish and little fish. Big fish have a tendency to, you know, do a better job of positioning themselves for the resources more than the little fish. And so little fish being small communities, we created a subset of the resources so smaller communities could come in and compete on an equal level for projects less than $50,000. Current allocations, as you see, for the project funds on round two, small incentive fund is a little over $1 million. Round three of the regular incentive fund totaling almost $9.5 million. Total allocations at this point in time are $10.5 million. Currently, for the round two, Exhibit D, which is the round that's the incentive fund that's underway, we have applications or requests for, and that's included also in the back documents, $13.8 million in requests for that round that's out right now, which would effectively, if those were all funded, which they will not all be funded, obviously, if they were all funded, would put us at a little over $3 million oversubscribed. But again, on the exhibits, it is a quick narrative of the name of the project, the location, the request, the type of request it is, be it a loan or a grant, and the total project cost, including the request and other sources, and a summary of what, a very general summary of what the proposal or the application it suggests to do for that community. And included in this information, I wanted to share with you, because I just want to make sure that there's a clear understanding. The next page right after the summary sheet on the front is the lift from the statutes. And I want to point out on page, third page back, or page 623 on the bottom of the statutes. Down in the lower right-hand corner, there are criterias that are part of the statutory responsibility of the funding of the Community Incentive Fund. And they are not necessarily all housing issues. This program was an Oregon Livability Initiative, which included housing and other attributes such as promoting housing development near jobs and transportation, revitalizing downtowns and community centers, and rebuilding rural and distressed economies. So I want to have you, as you look and review the applications, those have a flavor of the applications are a mix of those criteria. Not all housing, not all downtown distress, not all job creation, but there's a combination there. And then also, if you turn back to the front part of the statute page, this is accomplished not necessarily just totally by the agency. This is a group of advisory members that are listed by their either occupation or their interest in the roles and responsibilities of the incentive fund. And so there's a 13 or 14 member advisory group that reviews these and makes recommendations to the director. And you have everything from counties to cities to special districts to commercial builders to private builders to some of the agency people who have economic interests, banking organizations. And so, again, the decisions are made in an open environment where applications are reviewed, comments are made, and then decisions are decided by the advisory group. The only piece that we have tried to do with this is to make a form of equity, and equity is an important piece in Oregon, is that, you could sometimes argue that the amount of money that has been available through the incentive fund could easily be consumed totally by a large metropolitan area. And so we have taken these resources and divided them out in dollar values around the state so that you see in the end result of those that have been awarded in exhibits A and B that there is a reasonably fair and equitable distribution of the value or wealth of this dollar. As Mr. Krager, I think, mentioned yesterday, that 30 of the 36 counties have received incentive fund money from these first two rounds.
Senator Morris. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I understanding correctly that the total allocation under the current allocation of $10.5 million have not been committed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, the 10.5 is actually committed. What is not committed is the round that's out today, which is then the balance of the resources that still to be part of the bond sale also. We have some money in the bank from an earlier bond sale, and we still have another bond sale to go.
So that would represent the $8.5 million that was mentioned yesterday as being unallocated?
Correct.
Yes.
May I have some follow-up questions?
Certainly, sir.
What I would request, and hopefully it would be a consensus of the committee, and this is not made lightly because I know what these projects do. They're valuable. But in measuring relatively against the priorities that we're faced with and the dilemma we have with this financial crisis,
I would request, as an expression of the will of the committee, that these funds not be committed, that they be held in suspense until we can go through an evaluation, specifically asking our LFO staff to find out if the interpretation from legislative council would allow for these funds to be backfilled in your general fund account to be used for like-kind projects, and then relieve that general fund to be put into our, what you might say, our general fund savings reductions. And, you know, this is not made lightly. I know we've all received the wrath of everyone, so, I mean, what's a little more?
Gee, thanks.
I mean, it's been a common stage.
He's volunteered to do this.
Yeah, and he's helping, yeah.
I mean, we want to be a lightning rod, fine. But I do believe that we need to seriously look at this and see if any alternatives, in fact, do exist, and have our LFO staff do that research for us and bring it back. But in the meantime, that we hold in suspense any commitments that might be forthcoming.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes. Senator Morse, had you finished with that?
Yes, I'm.
Okay.
I
want to get back to that relative to positions. Okay.
I see where Senator Morse is going, but just a quick review of this makes it appear that we might need to change the statute. I mean, we set up an entire board for the purposes of giving out this money, and they have the sole authority, it would appear, in making those kinds of decisions. And so,
along with the government.
Unless you think you can go convince them not to spend the money we've given them to spend, which I suspect won't go down real well, we probably would need to have a conversation with the substantive committee. I think a lot of those conversations need to go on this session. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of places where, when the times were better, that we said this money needs to be spent here. Why not? It's a good. And you look through those list of projects, and you know, we're going to keep preschool kids warm and dry and educated and those kinds of things. So it's good stuff. Mm. But on the other hand, when we're kicking their grandparents out of nursing homes, it's time to take another look.
Liz, do you have anything to add?
No, I just wanted to add to that piece in the sense that also, since the governor does some of the appointing, it might be worthy to talk to some of the governors. If we see, and like you said, after he does research to see if it can be done, it might be worthy at that time.
Would you give any advice for us on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll do some investigation. We'll check with legislative council, have some conversations to see, number one, if it can be done. Number two, if what statutes would have to be changed. I know during the special session they worked on a lot of these types of issues, shifting funding around from one source to another. And I know they have language down there that can accomplish these kinds of things. I just don't know specifically what it would necessarily or need to be in this particular case. But we'll find out for you.
Director Refine, also, I'm looking at the Exhibit C list.
Yes, sir.
And I would hate to have, you know, Lars Larson or any of the rest of them get a hold of some of the things that are on these lists right here, because they really do look like for a time when we have such serious concerns, such as the comment that was made earlier about, you know, putting grandma out on the street, and we would have some of these projects going on that are beautification and things like that. I mean, in a time of great prosperity, I can understand that, but can you tell us what could be done to, because I'm looking at the statute that requires you to do certain things. Let's see if I can get back to that again. Promote, report about revitalized downtowns and community centers.
Sure.
How much flexibility do you have to where those dollars would go? Or do you feel comfortable that we're satisfying so many needs, you know, for housing for certain groups that we can afford to do those things?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my answer would be that the statute unfortunately doesn't react to the budgetary issues of the state of Oregon.
Right.
It is what it is when it's written, and so the flexibility is not designed with subject twos in it. I think with what we've tried to do with the Council of the Advisory Group is try to be very mindful of making sure that the investments are both wise investments and have leveraged and show reasonably strong justification why they should be accomplished in communities. And so it's not a lot of tough stuff in there. Now, if you look at it, you can always find something that you as an individual or even myself would say, well, if I had to do it over again, would I do that something different? And there's always that. But I think that the projects have been very well received by the communities. They have leveraged a tremendous amount of money in those smaller communities particularly and have been a nice piece of economic revitalization for those counties and cities. As to whether can I squeeze around the way the statute actually reads, it says the advisor group is to make recommendations to the director, then the director shall award. That's what the statute says. So I could say I'm not going to award. So I think I could freeze the award process by saying I'm not going to award. Whether or not then the question would be for legal counsel, whether or not could I then summarily just use those resources to meet some of the characteristics that were outlined in that statutory responsibility under those three principles, I don't know whether or not that would be a stretch, I think, in law.
Well, as far as changing the statutes to reflect what is the co-chairs, I've heard them describe it in committee along the line of great ideas that may need to be suspended for a few years.
Sure. And that can be a suspension could be put in place on this, too.
Senator Carter, then Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, I remember in what I call the good old days, and that's when I'm in power. Let's be real clear about me and my feelings here. I chaired the Committee on Trade and Economic Development, and we had local community initiatives. And the one thing that was made clear to us is that, because even we at this table, all of us at this table, get our feathers flared up when the federal government come in and tell us what to do. These local communities, and I know what you're looking at, Mr. Chairman, because it might sound fluffy to you and me sitting here, and we have, I think, in Springfield, a cultural something, Springfield Cultural District, and Lakeview Streetscape,
in the clubhouse.
Yeah, and Senator Duke's raising her just today in terms of whether the local community spent the $750,000, right?
This one is okay.
Yes.
The fact of the matter is
that we've already miffed the counties in terms of what we do. And for us to sit here today, I'm willing to investigate. But I think it's very presumptuous of us to sit at this table today and try to say to local communities how they're going to do whatever. And it might sound like fluff to us, but never forget it's economic development to them. So I don't mean to be raising my voice like this,
but I just want us
to be so reminded.
But these dollars would flow to a local community anyway.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, I know, but I mean, what we're saying is the priority right. The local community right now is looking at the same priorities we are.
Right.
And that's my concern.
Yeah, I understand that, but I just wanted to remind us of that. Raise the consciousness of us.
I have to go home to a county commissioner.
Yeah, I will call her,
Senator Morris.
This is a strange, Mr. Chairman, but this is a strange comment coming from a conservative Republican. But the dilemma for me, and the reason that I raise this issue is, we're confronted with issues. The question is, with the Oregon Health Plan, are we going to discontinue service for 130,000
animals? That's right.
Exactly.
And I know these are important.
Yes.
And I appreciate that.
Right.
But we've got to look at the bigger picture here. And that's what I'm asking. And a bit more specifically, I would ask that legislative fiscal in discussions with legislative council, if in fact there is implementing legislation required, that be drafted and submitted back to us, and then we can make a decision as to where we're going to take that. But I mean, these are Measure 28 failed largely on the strength of lack of trust in government and making wise decisions. And many of these projects, like you say, in good times, they're great.
Wonderful. Absolutely.
In tough times, when you're affecting people's lives and putting them on the street, literally, we need to defer and suspend and then come back to these things when we have
the time to do it.
Mr. Chairman, let me please say, I'm not against us raising the issues. Mm-hmm. I'm not even against us investigating. I'm not against that. But I think that we have to have a balance. And so I just want to be the consciousness of us today mm-hmm. in raising these issues, because to know that I will stand with you guys in raising the issues, but I am not going to stand with you when these local communities get their, you know, feathers furred. I'm not going to do that. And sometimes you have to do it. And you know me, if I get on an issue that I feel like I want to stand hard for, I'm willing to take that. But I'm not for state government going in. We've already took, I don't know how much from counties, and then all of a sudden we're going to leave them totally without any economic development. That's all I'm saying.
Senator, I don't think you voted with me in opposition to that. So.
Yeah, you're right.
Representative Smith.
You're right about that.
You were a yes vote, and I was a no vote.
Thank you, Chair George. This is a very good conversation. It's actually one of the most stimulating conversations I've had in Ways and Means so far.
I'm 25 minutes over getting this to the state fair.
I have to tell you, I'll never forget sitting in Les Schwab's office, sitting down and talking with him, and we had about a two-hour conversation, and one of the questions I asked him is, I said, how'd you get where you are? And without even a hesitation, he said, because I chose to invest when other people weren't. And what I would point out is a lot of what's going on here is investment at a time when investment is not popular. And I recognize where we are, and I recognize the situation we're in, and I support looking at any and all options. But let's keep in mind, we have communities out there that are struggling, and their struggle has become our struggle. And the sooner that we can get them on their feet, the sooner the state's going to get on its feet. And I would be very reticent to go through a list of these projects and say some of them have less value than others, because one, I don't know each and every one of these communities, but based upon the descriptions that are provided to me, I can see where many of them are the foundation of leading us out of the dilemma that we're currently in. I see good projects throughout the entire state. The question is, and I guess this is for our group to decide, is this a better use of these dollars than what everyone else is focusing on? So I would just keep in mind, though, what Les Schwab said, and that is you must be willing to invest when no one else is.
Representative Krieger, excuse me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, we've had a lot of discussion here, and Representative Smith just said, is this the time for better use of the dollars? And I think it's a matter of time, going back to it, Senator. Marcia said, is prioritizing. I looked at the little project you got in here for Bandon. Bandon has two nursing homes. If you were to ask the people in Bandon, do you want the money for the benches? Can you put that off a year? Or do you want to take care of your old people? I can guarantee you they're going to take care of the old people. And I wouldn't have a hesitate at all of going to my district and say I had to prioritize, and I chose the kids, I chose schools, I chose seniors over a park bench at this time.
Well, and I'm looking right now at one of them right here, and it sounds really nice. It's flower baskets and banners. It's in your district, but I'm sure you would come to the same conclusion that if you have a senior center or something like that, or a housing facility, it must be maintained. Okay, with that, are there any further questions there? Rick, you're going to look into that for us. And I think we'll have a very stimulating discussion as we get back to this thing.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask for just a little clarification? First of all, the list of the ones that are in the last round have not been scored yet, so there's plenty in there that probably are not going to meet the test of whether or not they'd be funded anyhow, because baskets and flowers are not one of the three categories. And we've had those before.
And banners.
The concern I have, and I just need some direction from you, is we have this third round out right now. As you see the applications, we'll be scoring those. We've advised the advisory group to come together, I think, next month sometime to start having the discussion on who will be awarded. If I can get some direction through your office or the LFO office on whether or not, if you would want us to, we can go through all the process of identifying, awarding, and not actually making the award, so it's kind of like setting on the shelf like a budget would be, subject to whatever you choose to do. But currently, I do have resources that I control that are not part of that bond sale that could be used for a reduced award for these applications that are currently in. So I just need some direction from you.
Yes, Chair, our time is limited. I'd be very interested if this committee chooses to go down this path to understand what the ramifications are, because the majority, as I understand it, the majority of the dollars that are invested through the Community Incentive Fund are dollars that are completing the last piece of many projects. And if we were to redirect those dollars, I would be very interested in knowing the impact that's going to have on other state, federal, and private funders, and the impact that's going to have on many of these projects that are in the near readiness to shovel dirt phase.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Smith, Representative Smith, is making a good point. I think the other point, this gets to be a little more complex. Realize that some of the resources that we do have are part of a tax bond sale we've already done, a tax exempt bond sale. So the question would be, because they were sold for intended purpose under the federal guidelines, and we would have to call those bonds, what would be the ramifications of calling those bonds that have already been issued? What's in the bubble, or what still hasn't been sold, obviously is subject to much of this discussion, but we do have some that we're still sitting on that are set for this second half that, in theory, could be used for any of these programs. But you'd want to also track the idea with the treasurers or DAS as to whether or not, what does it mean for the tax-exempt bond and the failure to use it for what it was intended it was sold for.
If you could get us a report on that would be very valuable. And also the additions that were made under 458.725 relative to the what I would just consider relatively new things that have been added to the mandated projects that you're responsible for. Because, a lot of times when we thought we had lots of money in the past, it was fine to do things. Right now, maybe we should review this at the legislative level.
Understand.
Okay, but I would appreciate a report that did have the detail of what the implications are of a decision we might make. Yes, Senator Duke.
Is it Exhibit D, or is that the one that hasn't been?
Exhibit D, the last.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out which ones D have already been spent.
D is the applications that are currently sitting in front of us that have not been reviewed.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, I know I'm well over my time. I'm apologizing to the state fair people. I told them I owe them an hour. To your question, Senator Dukes, I want to share the answer to your question was yes, $937 million was moved from purchasing food to payments for the drought victims of 2003. But in Oregon, we didn't see the overall drop because Oregon Housing Community Service worked directly with the Department of USDA in San Francisco. In San Francisco to acquire bonus commodities for the drought-stricken areas in Oregon, particularly in Klamath Falls.
Senator Carter.
I promise not to beat a dead horse today.
Yeah.
But I was looking over some of these Exhibit Ds, and I'm going to tell you guys. There's one that is involved in Northeast Portland that... where the gangs used to could hide and shoot out.
Right.
I'm going to be on it. I'm just serving notes. I'm going to be on it. Wild Wild West. It's
That's
not
right.
going to exist in Northeast Portland without all of you helping me. I stood up on the floor in 1985 and told all of you guys to help with gang activity before I get into your little small... Before I get into your little small bedroom communities, and you didn't do it, and I'm going to tell you how and me going to be on you about this project.
But maybybe it doesn't have to be out of this.
It's $800,000.
Not a problem. We've got a deal.
The problem, dear friends, is everyone has those problems. What about yours? I'm giving you your flower beds and your banners.
Okay, in the finality, Mr. Chairman, one of the questions that were asked by all the committee members or committees or agencies that are appearing in front of you is prepared to you in a document dated March 3rd. To this subcommittee from myself, talking about the 2003 and 2005 agency priorities. as you can imagine, as daunting as your task is to look at the general budget in the grander scale, is it just as painful and difficult for us to look at our budget, because each one of these programs means relationships, long-term commitments, and a lot of trust building over a long period of time. In this document, we've prepared this two ways. Now, we prepared the answer. We give you two answers. And the reason we've done this is because there's two ways to frame the answers to your question of what would be your priorities. The first list on, these are priorities 1 through 6 as we rank them.
No, it's not.
Where are we at?
Oh, on this little piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Have an extra one.
Come with the original packet.
Original packet.
Which day?
First day.
Just get an extra copy. That's it. Right? Okay. I have two.
You all got it?
I have another copy of something like that.
Mark, this? Sir?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, everybody got one?
Oops. Back here.
Oh.
Well, what we try to accomplish with this, Mr. Chair, is to the first cut that you see is, again, these are all general funded items, and they're listed also on one of the back page of one of the, you'll see a list that shows the priorities, general funded. These are all of our general funded programs. And we've listed the first run based on what we believe is critical service and community needs. So just holding that out as a criteria in itself. And these are listed in the reverse order, so as to say, if you were going to turn the lights out when you leave the building, what would you do last before you turn the lights out? So this list would suggest to you that, and again, these are not that we're advocating for these or suggesting these are not going to have consequences, but if you were asking us to base it on critical service and community needs, we have listed them in the following way. So the first thing we would suggest to you is reductions in the Housing Development Guarantee account. Next would be the reduction or elimination of the Oregon Commission on Volunteer Action and Services. Next would be the reduction in or elimination of the Home Ownership Assistance Program. If you notice what we've tried to do, and we are the housing agency or Housing Community Services, but we have guarded and we still guard today the last three components of being probably the most socially sensitive to your communities and to the state of Oregon, those being the homeless program, the community development corporations, which is our infrastructure to get good things done in your community at a local level, and our food programs. Those would be the last three, and then the food would be the last thing we would say to not fund as we turn the lights out. Now, that's from that perspective. We made another run at this, going from, and if you look at the second page of this document, we took another look at it from more of a business standpoint, not so much the tugging on your heartstrings standpoint. This was based on a series of criteria that are listed there: unmet needs, revenue generation, or i.e. leveraging, program outreach and effectiveness, and economic stimulus. Now, I will tell you that these are also made from our judgments, and so this is not having the influence of the partners who would be affected by this adding to the discussion, because obviously I've used this document before. You can imagine how many comments I've gotten after that I've said, this is the way we see the world. And they're saying, however, you didn't see it from our eyes. And so, I mean, to be respectful of those people, I agree, but this is from our inside the building. If you had to do it through these criterias, the order does change a little bit. And so, and again, it's based on leverage of federal dollars. I mean, there's some other criteria. There is a scoring sheet that we use as a criteria also included on your. And again, you'll see that the clusters of these, how we scored them, do not differ between 3 points in total to 4.1 in total. So they're all kind of bunched together on the way that these things were scored by us internally. So if you were to use this approach under prioritization, you would see. Actually, you pick up another priority seven because we've broken one out. First programs to go would be the community service expansion programs, rental assistance programs next, energy and weatherization programs. The food program drops actually to the number four instead of number one under this criteria. Home ownership program is third, affordable renting development is second, and homeless program is last. And again, this has a lot to do, as you can look on the matrix, you'll see why things were weighted different in order to reposition them. Neither one of these programs are, there's nothing scientific about this. It's the way we see these programs within the jurisdiction of the agency and how they fit against each other on a competitive process. So to the question that was asked, I think, by Senator Morris, if one was to prioritize, this is how we would see making recommendations. If you were to take general fund programs and take them away from the resources that are currently available to us.
Senator Morris, and Senator Carter.
Question. Given this list of priorities as kind of a maybe overarching priorities, would the lottery fund projects fall into this category?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I would say they would to some degree, not in all these categories. I don't think, I mean, not unless you, you would have to take the, if you froze or suspended the current lottery fund allocations and redirected them, you'd have to give, you'd have to open the redirection to allow them maybe to flow through the homeless programs and assistance programs. It probably is eligible for home ownership programs, because home ownership is a component of the current lottery criteria of the incentive fund. Probably would not be eligible for community services expansion programs, because those are more capacity building for infrastructure for for organizations, not so much built environment stuff. So you'd have to do some wordsmithing if you, depending on if you found that you had resources in excess of where you could place them in one line item here, then you would have to do some tweaking of language to broaden it to spill into some of these categories. And I'm sure any, you know, it can be done. I don't see that to be a problem.
Senator Carter.
Mr. President, that's you, President Stratton. But not the money to go with it. in looking at this ranking, I'm reminded of when I took over an agency that had a negative $800,000 deficit. And I don't know whether we had the opportunity to, some of us had the opportunity to look at this matrix. But this is an absolutely phenomenal matrix, and it really gets down to the nitty-gritty of what I think basic human services are. And so I'm hoping that we have a chance to really look at this so that when we go before the full committee and to talk about a case study for looking at basic human services, and one that I would not be ashamed to be on Lars Larson, Mr. Chairman, to talk about. I think this is very well done, and I want to give you kudos for doing this, because we are at the basic infrastructural need for serving people in the state while we're in this thing. But I just think that it's so important that state agencies retain the infrastructure of what they do, because the cost for redeveloping and redesigning a state agency, I don't think anybody has really, really thought about. And so whether we like it or not, if we're going to continue to value the things that Oregonians have valued over the years, we have to look at basic infrastructure, and I appreciate this a lot.
You're welcome.
Manager.
Right on time.
There's no next?
No, Madam Chair, that's the conclusion of my comments. I think we've responded to most of the questions.
Sure. Senator Morris.
I'm awful today.
Yes, are we all, Senator?
Could you give us some information in respect to the source of funds on your program advocacy and operational support? There's $15.8 million source of funding. Where that comes
what page are you on, Senator?
Page 33.
You'd like to know how that's broken down in terms of other fund, federal fund, general fund? Is that what
you're
doing?
I'm just wondering what is driving that. And maybe
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I'm glad to respond to that right now. If you would like to know how that particular $15.8 million is broken down. Just so you know, of that 15.8, $14.3 million of it is other funds, and $1.4 million of it is federal funds, and $75,000 is general fund.
Here.
follow-up? Where do the other funds originate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, the majority of those funds are generated from what is known as, and you heard me speak a little bit about this earlier, the Housing Finance Fund. It's our business operational account for all of our bonding programs. It is also, as I mentioned earlier, the fund that is taking a cutback because of the reduction that, or the shift of dollars that we took to the general fund. So it is a is one of our main sources of paying our administrative costs. However, it's a little smaller than it used to be.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
I would suggest any of the committee members have any further questions, let's put a note to Rick. Rick can get it sent to the agency heads or the appropriate department people.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5029 and for a short amount of time, open up a public hearing on 5520 at the top of the gavel. That will occur. I think those were mine.
I think so, too.
I'm just spreading out here.
That's okay.
I'm
too, obviously. I just
Senator, how are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Well, we're 45 minutes over on this one, so...
we're having a good time.
What, you finish the
well, day? I'll be quick.
No, don't do that.
This will be the fastest budget district.
Well, no.
I'm just kidding. You know, the sad part about this.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, I was looking at that last night. Mm-hmm. Priorities again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here this morning in my role as the chair of the Community Partnership Task Force with the Oregon State Fair, and Senator Courtney is the vice chair. I know some of you were here for two consecutive sessions when Senator Courtney and I had the opportunity and the responsibility to actually, and I believe Representative Hansen was also on the committee, where we took a really in-depth overview of the state fair. Those of you who were here before recall that there were several issues, and those issues surrounded whether or not we should continue the support of the Oregon State Fair, and two, whether or not the state fair could become a viable entity, and three, whether or not we should make some investment in the state fair. In 1999, after the review that Senator Courtney and I and others, we came to recommend to this body that indeed we should continue the Oregon State Fair. That Oregon really did need a place to celebrate, but not only if this body did its due diligence and treated the real estate at the Oregon State Fair the same as any landlord would do, that we could not only retain the state fair, but hopefully to make it to where it was economically feasible. We presented, I believe, in 1999, we provided a $10.2 million lottery bond with $2 million of those dollars to be used for repair and maintenance. And with the remaining $8.2 we dispensed those funds in the interim and to develop both the master plan and to begin some of the work for the future of the fair. We also did something else that I think was... that has assisted in putting the Oregon State Fair on some solid ground. We got a new fair manager who's with us now, Katie Cannon, and we gave her an extraordinary task because we said to Katie, within the limited dollars that you have, we want you to go in and become super efficient. We want you to look at your staffing. We want you to look at increasing the participation at the state fair with a very limited amount of resources to do it with. And we also said to the management that we were going to continue our oversight of the state fair. And we created, as you know, last session, the committee that I chair and which Senator Courtney is the vice chair. We added the community involvement by having the Chamber of Commerce, the city, and the county, so that truly we begin to have participation from all of the governmental entities as well as the business community. We said to them, last session we authorized another $10 million to carry out the master plan, which included the pavilion, which is a 5,000 seating multipurpose unit, and that was to start beginning to generate additional dollars. It's kind of interesting because we've made some critical directions to the fair, and they have attempted to implement what we have directed them to do. I'm mindful sometimes of the process that is used in order to get from what we directed them to do with all the layers that the Oregon State Fair has had to go through, because we're still waiting on the pavilion, and that's because of all the process from Capital Planning Commission to all of these layers. Hopefully by July 4th, we will have the pavilion. We're anxiously looking forward to that. The fair has come a long way from the time when it was, when I think every e-board, they were coming and asking for more money. It's come a long way from where the management at the staff was very, very questionable to a place to where the management of the staff has been doing a superior, outstanding job. And I just wanted to come this morning and share some of that with you, that I've been very, very pleased and impressed with the work that has been done at the State Fair and with the turnaround that has occurred here in Oregon. Additionally, one of the components that we had asked them to do is to work closely with the county fairs so that we truly did have a connection between the counties and the state, and that truly we were placing a lot more emphasis on building strong relationships between those two entities, and they have been doing that. So I'm wearing my passport, my chairmanship hat, and coming in support of the work that the Oregon State Fair is doing. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kate.
Senator Dukes.
Do Marion County and the City of Salem contribute financially yet?
Marion, and I'll let Katie asks, we've had ongoing, Marion County, as you know, participates with their fair is at the fair. and of course they pay. They don't get to use the fair for nothing. It's not a gratis piece at all. The feasibility study, as you know, that drove this discussion, the participation was both the state, county, and the city in order to get this done. The other pieces is that there's some indirect in-kind that comes from the city through their police departments and other things like that, and I'll let Katie elaborate on some of the specifics.
So is the answer that no, they're not making a direct financial contribution yet? Okay, I remember sitting here, I think it must have been 4 years ago when we had a city councilor in here telling us that they would rather that we sold the property and put it back on the income tax than that we continued it here, which shocked me. Considering the economic development that thing is,
well,
there was no way they were going to contribute. So
we have a new mayor.
Okay.
I have to say that.
So I shouldn't expect that city council to come again.
You won't expect that city. You know, but you know the state, the impact of the state fair economically. You know, you're looking at $137 million is their total impact. It's huge. And, you know, just even outside of Salem, it's huge. And, you know, when Senator Courtney and I looked at this, and we really agonized. Robin was with us because we would have breakfasts early in the morning, and poor Robin would have to come all the way from out of town, Eugene, to come in to be with Senator Courtney and I. And it was, truly, can we get the partnerships with city, county? Truly, can we also, as a state who has responsibility for the real estate, make all this happen, and also to create an environment where it's economically feasible. And the pavilion, you know, which we're really looking forward to, because the fair, as you know, is only a 12-day period, and we have to build on that real estate some events that will allow that the fair to have something 365 days a year rather than just the 12 days. And so the investment, part of the investment is in the a pavilion, but I know also that there's a bill going through that we're working on with the foundation to create the foundation that will be working in partnership with the fair, bringing in other private resources into the fair. So it's a lot further along than when we talked before, and it helps to have a new mayor.
Senator Carter?
My apologies to Senator Winters and to the Fair Association. I do attend the fair, but I have to be in Portland in 45 minutes, and if the police are not watching, I'll make it in 35, and but I'm going for Girl Scouts, and when you get close to those kids, that's my heart, and so forgive me for having to be excused.
And we'll, Representative Miller and I will count on your support on the speed bill.
Mr. Chairman, yep. There are some things that are born out of necessity, and there are some things that are born out of having a systematic approach to trying to manage the best of your state's resources, and having a speed where we are in the all-out fight for the West again is not one of my things. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that in mind, if you don't mind, I'd be excused.
Katie, now, do you have a Robin Somi, you have
your fair board.
Fair board chair?
Yes. Well, my chair is in the hospital right now.
Okay.
She's had surgery. Larry Amold, who was our previous chair and on the board, he's
And if you don't have any further questions for me, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome.
Katie, obviously we are way behind
yeah,
here, and so we're going to assume a more of a formal process later.
Okay.
And so if you'd like to have him speak, that would be great, and, or however you decide to handle it.
Chair George, can I please respond a little bit further to Senator Dukes?
Certainly.
As far as actually having the city and county write us a check, I have a letter from the AG, I think it was... from our assistant AG, it was in 1998, that it actually indicates that may not be legal to do. And the reason why is if they're providing money to us and it's benefiting people outside their geographic area, they can't legally give us money. Okay, but I get a tremendous amount of service from both Marion County and the state, or the city of Salem, as far as I think very important services. For example, Environmental Health right now is working with us very closely on the E. coli problem. The fair industry will be very aware of this year because of what has happened down at Lane County. We've had a preventative program for years, but we work with them every year. If I had to pay for that kind of consulting, it would cost me a lot more than what I could afford to pay. So we get a tremendous amount of service from both the county and the city in a lot of different areas.
Chair, thank you. Those things are very important. What surprised me when it was presented to us was we have 34, 35 counties with county fairs.
Mm-hmm.
And do we now have 36? Okay, we got the last one. Good. And they're all struggling. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, with their county commissions and their, you know, feed businesses and all this kind of stuff, they cobble it all together. For the kids in the local community, and they hold their county fairs. And it was very clear to me 4 years ago that Marion County was delighted to have us host their county fair.
Excuse me, Katie, could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
For the record, I'm Katie Cannon. I'm the director of the Oregon State Fair. I should know better.
And their attitude was so poor at the time. It was as though it was a riot, and the city of Salem's was even worse. And I think Salem is probably where the state fair ought to be and remain, and we ought to be making an investment in our buildings. But we do it for the state, but there are a lot of people who can't travel to Salem to take advantage of that. So the major beneficiaries of that fair are right here. And they certainly, they may not be able to write us a check, but they certainly would be able to get out and pour the foundation or do, you know, the cleanup and do some major help in renovation because we need it so badly and things like that. And so I was just anxious to see whether their attitudes had changed, and they were willing to step up to that and do what any other county who wants to keep a county fair in their backyard is willing to do. It doesn't sound like we're there yet, but maybe you'll convince me that we are.
Chair George, Senator Dukes, we have had a change in the city council and the mayor, and that has a remarkable change on attitude. For example, even on the pavilion with the SDCs, we have a considerable reduction in the SDCs in building that building there, about $225,000, so which is tremendous because my budget is so skinny on that $10 million building that anything helps. But, yes, we're working very closely with them.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Chair George, it's interesting. Senator Dukes raised a point about the majority of folks who utilize the fair come from this area. I would bet
the majority of the benefit from this
the majority
from
of the benefit
from the fair is here.
I guess my observation is I'll bet you if we look per capita, I'll bet you the distribution of folks who attend the fair is pretty evenly. So, for example, you take Wheeler County, the smallest county that has 1,400. I'll bet you per capita they have a larger percentage of turnout at the fair than, say, Multnomah County here. The reason I raise that issue is I'll bet you the benefit is truly statewide and the use per capita is statewide. Just an observation.
Chair George, Senator Dukes, another issue, though, you would be surprised. We had an economic impact study completed in 1998 before I came to the fair. I went back and looked at that again. 45% of the economic impact of the $137 million is outside of the city of Salem and Marion County. I was amazed. I went back and looked at that. Even had Cliff check it to make sure I was looking at it correctly.
Year round.
The majority of the benefit, economic benefit, is actually in the expo events that we have, the other 281 events we have throughout the year. But overall, when you look at all of it, 45% of the economic impact is outside of the city of Salem and Marion County.
6% right here.
That's right.
My name is Larry Amold. I live at 15468 Northwest T Court in Portland, Oregon, and I was past chair last year and continue to serve on the commission. And I'd just like to echo Director Katie and Senator Winter's comments about continuation of the fair, and Senator Winter's alluded to the fact of county participation. We've added two county members from Tillamook County and Jefferson County to our commission to give input and have a better relationship and rapport with the counties of the state of Oregon. And Representative Smith, you are correct that there's statewide participation, and it's just, it's, you know, whether it's 4-H or whether it's county participation or FFA, it is a statewide fair, even though we have. Thank you, Senator George.
Well, then we need to decide where we're headed here. Can the members stay for a little bit, Robin? Maybe it would be the best thing for have your presentation, and then and then we'll decide how we're doing on time. Did you go ahead?
You look like you had a question.
Oh, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'm good for a few minutes.
Okay.
Well, then I'll make this very quick. I'm quite good at that.
You have your packet.
You have the packet. I also sent it to you yesterday evening. The memo is, as I have distributed on other agencies, lists the budget notes, which the agency will talk about what they have done in response to that. But they have appeared in front of the emergency board in response to those budget notes, and I've listed that there. There haven't been any interim reports or studies or any fee adjustments requiring legislative action. They do have the authority to raise fees without legislative approval. There have been a number of studies that have been done in recent years that include state-to-state comparisons. So if anybody's got any questions, let me know. I'll see what we can get for you. We're going to be working on the vacancy report, and I had noted that the prioritized list of services would be provided by the agency because I didn't have it when I sent the material out, but you now have it attached to the material that you have. Moving on to my PowerPoint presentation, the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center has basically four programs. They conduct an annual state fair. They have ongoing exposition center programs. They have a capital construction program that is in progress, and they have debt service on bonds that were issued for capital construction. On page four of my handout, I break out what percentage of the state fair is in those different program areas, where their expenditures are. Right now, capital construction is a large chunk of their expenditure. And that is also illustrated in the following slide, which shows a significant increase in other funds as a result of the $10 million that was provided for capital construction. The primary issues that you're going to be dealing with in this budget are staffing for the multipurpose building, the impact of the general fund reductions on their programs, and they will spend, I think, a significant amount of time talking to you about how critical that relatively small amount of general fund is to their ongoing operations, and their capital construction and maintenance needs. And I will point out that the governor's recommended budget does not provide resources for maintenance or for capital construction funds to complete their strategic plan, their modernization master plan. And again, the agency will talk to you about what that is and what the issues are. And then following that is the LFO analysis of the budget. And I would be happy to answer any questions. Is that quick enough?
That was quick. You want to get the priority issue later?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I would apologize to all of you from the fair that we were so far over on that. But we will we'll have to close down now at this time because we're all headed to the floor. Thank you for being here. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5520, State Fair's Budget. With tap the gavel will be adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Is this supposed